Is it trying to?
I've read that that after you were in the Pentagon, you were assigned to the 13th Infantry Command in Colorado.
Yes.
You took the division to West Germany under Operation Gyroscope.
Gyroscope. Yes. That was an experimental system that we had at the time, 1956. We wanted to keep families together, to get stability in the Army at that time, and so we adopted a system called gyroscope, where the unit, the soldiers, with their wives, children, furniture, automobiles, everything, was transported simultaneously. A wonderful system. The system worked very, very well, but we couldn't afford it. Just too expensive. We had to go back to the individual system that people going back for.
Mm-hmm. That we have presently. So.
Yeah. Huh. I wish we could afford the other.
From Germany, you were in Germany for several years?
Three years.
And your responsibilities there were?
I had two responsibilities. Once I took the regiment, trained it for 6 months about in Colorado, and then went over to Germany. Went first to ULM down southern part of Germany, and then moved the regiment back to Mannheim. After I had commanded that regiment for 3 years, I moved from Mannheim to Stuttgart, where I was the training officer, G3 training officer for the entire army in Europe. And I had that assignment for a year. I came back from there and went to the National War College.
What did you study at the War College? What were your major areas of study?
The War College, as such, is designed to be our training for strategic war. They have 33 students from the Army, 33 from the Air Force, 33 from the Navy and Marines combined, and 33 from the State Department, or the civilian component, the State Department and the other State Department together. Almost exclusively the State Department, however. And it is opposed train the senior officers of the armed forces for negotiations, for mobilization, for supply, strategic movements, and conduct of the war.
And then after the War College, you were back at the Pentagon again.
Back to the Pentagon on the Army staff.
Uh-huh. What was your assignment then?
Personnel. The personnel bit.
What division was it?
I was the chief of a division that handled all of what they call the spaces and the initial training for the worldwide army for a while. another division called the Requirements Division, which looked over to see what the Army needed for the future. And then I was executive of the Directorate, which handled both the Authorization Division, the Requirements Division, and the Budget Division. So I had three different jobs.
Now, you started out before the Kennedy administration. I mean, you were back in the Pentagon before Kennedy was president, I think. I'm not sure about the chronology, but I was just wondering what the impact of Robert McNamara might have been.
In the McNamara days, but I'll have to get my years straight.
According to my chronology,
I had four different tours in the Pentagon, and of those tours, I had several jobs. Kennedy was killed after I left the Pentagon and went to Okinawa. So yes, Kennedy was there, and I did have quite a bit of association with Robert Kennedy, not with President Kennedy, with Attorney General Kennedy.
Yeah, I guess according to my chronology here, you were with the Personnel Division in July 1960, before Kennedy was elected. But did McNamara's regime make much difference for the way your work conducted?
Very much different. Mr. McNamara is an oddball study if there ever was one. From our experience, and I learned to know him reasonably well, and he visited me a good time sometime later in Vietnam. And I can say of Mr. McNamara that every single time I saw him face to face and presented a subject to him, he understood. I don't believe he counteracted me or turned me down one single time. Mr. McNamara, very intelligent man. Mr. McNamara had a flaw, though, a very fatal flaw. He was too smart. Too smart for his own good. He could gather facts, he could understand quickly, he was so sharp, he was so quick, that he wanted to personally make all decisions. Well, there's no way in the world that one individual can talk with all of the people who are in charge of many, many, literally hundreds and hundreds of different projects, understand what people were trying to do, and then approve or disapprove them. So Mr. McNamara gathered around him a bunch of what we call whiz kids, also smart people that were sharp, could understand what. But that group of whiz kids was most detrimental to the overall system. And the reason they were is the working level would come in and take, say, 20 minutes apiece to explain a subject to a man that had never even heard of the subject before. Absolutely new, fertile ground. The guy would present it to the fellow. The fellow understood exactly what he was saying, but then he was charged with taking that 20-minute presentation and presenting that, along with 15 or 20 others, to Mr. McNamara in segments of about 20 seconds each. So Mr. McNamara was getting a very drastically watered-down presentation of what could have been a complicated subject. What might have been all right, except for the flaw of a situation that if Mr. McNamara asked one of his quiz kids a question, the whole house of cards fell down because the quiz kid had failed to ask the question during the 20-minute presentation, and he had no knowledge at all beyond what he had just been told. And there was Mr. McNamara making dozens and dozens of hip shots based on what an almost totally, certainly totally uninformed individual just the day before. So this kid, and I call them kids because most of them were quite young, this kid had sat all day long listening to people come in and explain these things that needed to be done, decisions that needed to be made. And at the time, he understood exactly what he was told. Then he went in and in machine gun fashion tried to fire 22nd missiles at Mr. McNamara. And Mr. McNamara wasn't hesitant a bit in the world. He'd say, yes, no, just like bang. But if he says, I have a question, the whole thing fell apart.
That's interesting.
And the system really fell of its own way because Mr. McNamara wanted to centralize too much. And Mr. McNamara, in the last few months, has come up with some screwball ideas that I don't agree with at all, but every time that I talked with him, he was a very reasonable individual, and I can't fault him for anything that I told him. He came over one time to Vietnam with a very preconceived idea that the M16 machine gun, the M16 rifle, was worthless. It shouldn't be procured. It shouldn't be bought. And he looked me straight in the eye and said, what do you think of the M16? And in about 4 or 5 minutes, I told him. And he turned to a man that I didn't know who was there with him and said, just buy $400,000. Just a flat stake. He gave a direct to that man to start the system into producing 400,000 M16s because I convinced him it was good. I had had the experience with him, with it. He had been talking with a bunch of people that didn't know what they're talking about, and I explained it to him, and he understood. And I said, the only thing wrong with the weapon is you or somebody in the chain of command permitted it to be issued to the troops too fast. I said, I got them in Okinawa. I learned the weapon. I learned to use it. I learned to take care of it. It is serving me beautifully. You handed it to some people just before they start into the jungle. They don't know the weapon, and it won't work. It's a lot better than anything else the enemy has, a lot better than anything I know of that anybody else has at this time. Mm-hmm. And we fought more like that. Hmm. I told you I had some ideas that I believe in.
Yeah, right.
And some of them that I do, yeah. I believe them rather strongly.
Uh-huh. Now you talked a little bit earlier about your Okinawa experience, and then you went to Vietnam from there.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be interesting to talk about Vietnam with you, but have you been interviewed by other people about the war?
Oh,
I mean, are there oral history projects or...
Yes.
Yeah. Can you mention a couple of the projects that you've been interviewed? Just so people will know where they can look at the transcripts if they're interested.
Well, I had a long interview with the chief marine historian. Mm-hmm. I have... First name is Cliff, and I can't think of his last name. He's written a complete book on it. A guy named Lanning, who's writing a book on the small long-range patrols in Vietnam. I've made speeches at several universities. Several military installations.
the transcript you used is from the Marine Historical Office. Will that be available for researchers to use or to look at?
I would imagine.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah,
I would think so.
Yeah. You said you had two tours of duty in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. What? My first tour was, as mentioned, with the 173rd Airborne Brigade. I went over there. We went in May of 65, and I came out a year later.
Mm-hmm.
I came back to Fort Benning, the infantry school, for a while as assistant commandant. Got promoted out of that job right away and went down to command Fort Polk in Louisiana. It was a training center. Stayed down there for 2 years. Then went back to Vietnam in 68 and 69, and commanded the 25th Division.
And then after Vietnam, you were with the Reserve Component?
After Vietnam, I came back here to the office of the Chief Reserve Component, which took care of the Army Reserve and the National Guard. And I went from there to Iraq.
Now, how was it that you were assigned to the Army Schmag in Tehran? You said you weren't too happy about the decision. How was the decision made?
I don't know. That's a long story. We have a standing deal in the Army that we don't publicize why general officers are assigned here or there very much. I'll tell you, it's not, there's no secret there, but it's just not the type thing that the Army publishes.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, the armed forces in Iran went through evolution. I didn't cover the fact that it started just for the Army. It was called the Army Mission. We had MAGs in other countries that were called MAAG, Military Assistance and Advisory Groups. But in Iran, for some reason that I do not understand, it was just the Army. It may have been the fact that that's all there was at the time. But anyway, sometime later, the decision was made to, in addition to helping the Army, to help form an Air Force and a Navy. And they started thinking in terms of making it a MAG. And they already had all the agreements for the Army. Just frankly, the agreements were more favorable in Iran than any other country. So the decision was made, we don't want to negate that bilateral that we already have with Iran. So instead of knocking that out and forming a MAG, they left the Army mission as such and added MAG. So Iran was the only country in the entire world that had what they call an Armish MAG. So it had the combination of the two. I'm telling you that because we started off training just the Army at a relatively low level, very, very low level, and then started the expansion. We had one general over there, a series of generals that were operating or training them at very low level. Then the decision was made to, for the white revolution it was called, to expand considerably, broaden the field. So we sent over a chief of mission that was basically a staff officer, General Twitchell.
Mm-hmm.
General Twitchell was an organizer and planner. He was a staff officer. And we sent him over to organize and plan the expansion program. Good job, I think. But then, as luck would have it, when it was about time for him to leave, our chief of staff, General Westmoreland, went over to Cairo, to that part of the world, and stopped by in Iran. And he and the Shah were discussing General Twitchell's replacement, because General Twitchell was becoming a retiree. And the Shah mentioned that he wanted a broader individual than just a staff officer. He wanted somebody this, that, that. Just frankly, they got charmed by their own bosses, and they started talking in terms of, oh, well, we ought to have a man that could this, that, and that, that, that. And finally, they wound up with, as it was explained to me, five criteria. An advanced degree in foreign affairs so that they could think on a strategic level. And they wanted armored experience in the region. They wanted a pilot. They wanted a National War College graduate. And anyway, they started talking about all these things. And General Westmoreland just didn't come to mind that he had already recommended someone to go over there and replace Hans Twitchell. Shaw remembered it. Shaw didn't want that guy. He wanted somebody with a different type of experience. The two parted with General Westmoreland basically saying, oh, yes, we can furnish a guy with all those capabilities. No problem. He came back and he had a total of two major generals available that had all five of the qualities. And he called me in. I'm going to have to do something very, very serious. I said, what's that? He says, I'm going to have to do your promotion for about 2 years. This is, he told me the name of the other guy that he thought was that. And he says, I just told Shaw that, sure, we could do this. This would be no problem. He says, I never realized it would be this much of a problem. And, in the final analysis, I went and didn't walk through. Mm-hmm. That's the way it worked.
When did you arrive in Tehran? About when?
I think it was July or September.
Mm-hmm. Was General Twitchell still there when you arrived? Or did he, had he left?
General Twitchell stayed about 2 weeks after I arrived. He had the final wrap-up plan for the expansion. Was being put to print, and General Twitchell wanted to stay and personally present it. And, mm-hmm. So there was no overlap with that one.
Mm-hmm. Did you bring any staff people with you from Washington? Did you bring any staff with you? Or just
one aide? One captain who had been my aide for a short while in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Just happened to be in Washington. Wanted to go with me. I warned him very badly.
Who is this?
Captain Santone. He's retired now and a very, very successful lawyer down in Miami. Has his own law firm. Which is great.
Have you got a Sam?
S-A-N-T-O-N. Santone.
Uh-huh.
Carl. K-A-R-L.
Uh-huh.
Santone.
Oh, okay.
If you're interested, I have his address.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I just met him in London last month or last.
Hmm.
A very enjoyable time with him.
And where was the MAG located? Where were the offices located in Tehran?
In Tehran. And we had an arrangement there that was not true, so far as I know, anywhere else. My office and my so-called head staff was in the Imperial Building with the commander of the Imperial Staff, General Asghari, who incidentally was the last Prime Minister over there.
Mm-hmm.
But as opposed to having all of my headquarters assembled, I had General Patton out with his part with the Army, General Drouin, General Price initially, and his Air Force people with the Air Force staff that was in a different part of the city, and Captain Harwood, Chief of Navy, Texas. So my headquarters was in four different places in the city.
Hmm.
Plus, I had two field teams, one in Shiraz and one in Esfahan.
You mentioned some of the service representatives.
Mm-hmm.
Mentioned their names a minute ago. Who are some of the other key officials, or major important officials in the military mission that you are? Did you have important advisors that were very, very helpful for you? Who are some of the major people in your staff?
I had an assemblage of very, very experienced people. Mm-hmm. The reason for that was the fact that a lieutenant colonel or a colonel over there on my staff was operating at top level in a tight position that would have a two-star general here. And we were able to give them, in addition to meeting good, experienced people, we were able to give them additional experience on a level that they couldn't have gotten for another 6, 8, 10 years here in the States. So it was a reasonably sought-after position. So I had a logistician over there initially, Colonel Sam Duncan, later Colonel Hall, real fine on the logistician.
Mm-hmm.
Well, across the board, I had a good operations man, good intelligence man, pretty good.
It's probably hard to generalize, but what were your basic duties as chief of Army Schmag?
I had two major. One, I was the commander of the U.S. military personnel. Mm-hmm. If I recall, it was about 160 people, so most all of them officers. Very, very few enlisted men. Most all of them field grade officers. In fact, the requirement was supposed to all be majors and above, but they did have a few. So my job was to command them and guide them, and coordinate them, and do whatever is necessary as they provided advice to the military departments, as I provide advice to chief of the Imperial Staff. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, my office was not only on the same floor, but on the same hall with the top military man. I also worked very, very closely with General Tufani, who at that time was Deputy Minister of War for Procurement. So he handled all procurement and all manufacturing in country. So in addition to working as an advisor among the assistants, I went in periodically, either on my request or at the Shah's request, and just sat down with what you might call it. They called it an audience, but it was the equivalent almost of a seance, because I would go in. I have always, as I mentioned, I just try to go two different places every week. So I had a feel for what was going on outside of Tehran. And I would go in with a fair amount of observations. I would take with me a status report of all the major programs we were working on, which, of course, was a duplication of what he'd been told to a great extent by his own people.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was subject to anything that he wanted to talk about. And that fell into many categories. But I mentioned quite often my information duplicated what he had already been told by his own people. One day he reached over and put his hand on my shoulder and he says, "You will never appreciate how valuable you are to me." And I made some comment about it, very kind, but I don't quite understand what he's referring to. He says, "In a monarchy type government, it's awful hard for the top man to get his subjects to be completely candid with him." He said, "They so frequently work very, very hard, in fact, almost without exception, work hard at telling me what they think I want to be. And he said, you will tell me exactly what you think, and I know that you don't. He spoke with us. He knew all the little idiosyncrasies of our language, and he spoke with us crazy like. He says, I know you don't have a bone to pick. He says, you're not trying to sell me anything. You're trying to tell me what you think, and I appreciate that so much. And he says, if you think I'm wrong, you're polite about it, but you let me know that you think I'm wrong. So I often got myself in a position of just being a bounce board, a backboard for ideas. And in that, it expanded after about 6 months, well beyond the military. And this got me in trouble quite frequently. The State Department just crawled up and down the walls. Why is General Williamson discussing agriculture in Khuzestan? See, because after each audience, I'd write up a message called an audience report and shift it back, and it would get dispersed to the State and Defense Departments. Then the State Department Economic Counselor would get upset down there. But, and I'd have to always go back and say, look, I didn't discuss this with him. I listened. He brought up the subject. I never bring up the subject except military items. Anytime there's an audience subject other than military, you can always be sure that he initiates. But if he asked me something about fishing, such as he did several times, I'd tell him, I said, I used to say, I don't know. Or I'd tell him what I do know, and tell him entirely personal. He knows it. But there was another aspect that was very, very important. I served under three different ambassadors. Each one of them had a personality of his own. Douglas MacArthur, as you know, was a very, very strong personality. And, but he didn't back up anything. He was a good man. A little bit hard-headed, aren't we all? And then Dick Helms was he'd use the word sleazy, but he was an adroit type individual. It wasn't bang right down the middle like MacArthur was. But each of those two was interested in knowing information that helped them do their job better. Mm-hmm. Each one of them didn't care whether they went to the palace and got it, or whether I got it, or who else got it. It just wasn't a contention. We had one other ambassador over there.
Joseph Fallon,
that was not near as sure of himself as the other two were. And he sort of resented the fact that the Shah talked to him a lot of things that he really should talk to the ambassador about. But the Shah talked to me not because of my personality. Well, not totally anyway. But not because of my knowledge. But the Shah knew that he could talk to me and I would get it to the U.S. at State Department, Defense Department level, and it would be considered and worked into the overall meal. If the Shah asked a question of the ambassador, that technically was the equivalent of his personally asking the President of the United States. The ambassador is the representative, not just about the government, he's the representative of the President. And the Shah recognized it as that. He says there are some questions that should not be asked or answered by the top man. He said the same questions can be answered at working level, flashed out all the innuendos, all the technicalities, all the problems considered. And if the answer is no, he says, you can say no. And then you can go tell General Azhari or General Tufani that through your channels, the answer comes out no. And I don't have my nose out of joint. But if I ask President Nixon and he says no, then just diplomatically, I have to say why. He says, all the time, I don't care why. He says, if the answer is no, it's all right. So the communication between the Shah and the United States was greatly enhanced by the fact that he could talk to me, and it didn't have to go down as an official imperial decree or question. And I could work it through the mill and come back. A lot of career foreign service diplomats don't like that. Because as somebody said to me one time, I don't look very good in striped pants. I never was trained to be a diplomat.
Was your access to the Shah pretty much unrestricted? Could you see him when you thought it was necessary to see him?
I was never refused one single time. I never went in on a malice before. I always went in by appointment. But when I got there to the palace, his chief of staff, Mr. Elam, he would take me to the waiting room. There may be as many as a dozen other people waiting. Four-star general. I went in next. Embarrassing. It was embarrassing. But I had total access to the Shah. And during the entire time over there, I don't think I ever was in his office less than an hour and 45 minutes. He always says, let's have a cup of coffee.
Did you usually meet alone?
I'd say it'd be dozens and dozens of meetings. I was completely by myself with him. Every time except maybe it happens.
Now, as Chief of Army Schmeg, where were you in the chain of command? Who did you report to? The Joint Chiefs of Staff or the Sinker?
I reported technically to the Secretary of Defense. However, most every message that I sent back by agreement had only address line, the State Department, and if I thought it was of interest, it would go directly to the Army Commanding Air Force. I was not restricted in that chain. I could also go to the military departments with a question without going through the Secretary of Defense. However, I think without an exception, unless it's a very, very routine, I put the Secretary of Defense information copy on the message. But I exchange messages direct with the departments daily.
Daily?
I'd say that's pretty close to that.
What kind of decisions could you make on your own as Chief of Army Schmeg? And what kinds would have to be coordinated with Washington or the embassy?
I'm somewhat of a loss as to how to answer that. First of all, I was the commander of my people. I handled all the administrative, the disciplinary, the name it, all that. Nobody asked me a question on that. That was my job. Yeah. I did that on my own. Mm-hmm. Right. But as far as, quote, decision making, most every decision that I was called on to make, I had two fields. One was what you might call the decisions, and the other was the advice. The decisions I was called on to make, almost all of them involved committing U.S. access, U.S. assets. or U.S. production, or U.S. something. And I don't recall my ever committing to the United States anything without clearing it. No one ever told me I couldn't. But it would have been most imprudent for me to say, oh yes, you can have two batteries of Nike missiles. I wouldn't have dared make a decision of that sort without finding, first of all, I had to do what they call a P&A, a price and availability. And that was, the Iranians want to buy so-and-so, give me a P&A. In other words, and if they came back with a P&A, that of course meant the sale was approved, or would probably approve. They'd come back and say the price includes the end item, the 1 year supplies, the technical manual, the technical training, what have you. So the price comes to this, and the availability can be 18 months from that. Mm-hmm. So that would be my P&A. And then the Iranians would take the P&A and sign a letter of intent which said, yes, I accept the P&A. I want to buy that 19, 20 months from now at that price. Then that was the signal for the U.S., and this was always done back in the U.S., for the U.S. to write up a contract. Their signing a letter of intent meant that Iran wanted to make that purchase to such an extent that if they decided not to make the purchase, they would pay all of the U.S. expenditure funds that they had made in the preparation of the contract. In other words, the U.S. would have to go out to the producer and say, we have this request, can you do it? And there would be travel involved and telephone calls, administrative expenses and things of that sort. And they'd come up with a contract that was looked reasonable to the U.S. and the producer. And Iran would sign a contract with the U.S. government. Sounds complicated, but this is the way it works. Not with a commercial producer. They signed a contract with the U.S. government. And the U.S. government then was bound to get that item within 10% of the agreed price or go back to the country and say, can't do it. They have 10% plus or minus relay. If it came in less than 10%, they'd go back and say, we can get these for 70%. Do you want this number or would you like to add a few more to get up to it? Closer to 100%. So it was a rather long, drawn-out thing, but we had a system worked out that it could be expeditiously handled if something really was necessary. But I still want to repeat, I never advise them to buy anything. And I'm very, very often suggest that maybe it would be better if you buy less at a slower rate. A few things I told them, just don't think you're going to buy less. And we were working under a very, very stringent system in that when President Nixon came over, he and Michelle talked. And before they even started that, they excluded nuclear weapons, so there was no nuclear involvement at all. But President Nixon said, if we are producing it and you want it, we'll sell it to you. And basically that's about how it went, which really made life hard for me because there was such a strong element back here in the United States saying that Iran was developing too rapidly and constantly telling me to slow down, slow down, slow down. And I frequently was successful in slowing them down.
That's interesting.
And there were a few, very few extremely sensitive thing to a certain extent. But I don't care to name them now, but I can tell you they were the type things that, if gotten in the wrong hands, could be very dangerous. A few sensitive things that were non-nuclear that we didn't want them to have.
And they didn't.
So I finessed it, you might say, and delayed it to such an extent that they lost it.
Oh.
But that was a narrow line to travel at times.
Why not tape again?
Layman by the name of Hubert Crosby, and he was on the search committee, and he'd been a strong member of that board. We were meeting in Hubert Crosby's study in Greenville, Mississippi, and I remember that afternoon, suddenly he turned to me and he said, "Why don't you take the job?"